That's kind of conversation between the soul. That's conversation between the soul and the night.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade, Derek Davison, and we're very excited to welcome back to the podcast today, Thea Riafrancos. Thea is an associate professor of political science at Providence College and author of the recently released Extraction, The Frontiers of Green Capitalism. So, Thea, thanks for joining us once again.
Thanks for having me back.
So why don't we start with the book's central problem as you perceive of it? Because like a good Marxist, not to say you're a Marxist, I don't know, I assume you are thinking dialectically. So what are the tensions? What are the two theses that will need to be transcended so that we don't cook our planet? Why don't you start with that and we'll go from there?
There is a central dilemma that animates the whole book and then a bunch of subsidiary contradictions, we might say, that flow out of that. But the central issue that drew me to this topic is the contradiction between two desirable things. On the one hand, we need rapid, urgent, holistic climate action. And climate action is not just diplomacy. It's not just words. It's not just agreements or multilateral institutions, which are kind of going up in flames right now. It is actually concrete material deployment of technologies and infrastructures to completely transform the built environment to get to a zero emissions economy and society and stave off the absolutely worst and most catastrophic scenarios of global warming. So that's one thing we need to do and would be a desirable outcome. Another desirable thing is to protect local communities from the ravages of resource extraction, to conserve biodiversity, which is its own crisis related to the climate change, but also with independent drivers, to protect indigenous rights, to allow people to flourish in the places they live and the landscapes they live in and the livelihoods they currently enjoy. And that is also a set of desirable things that also addresses a bunch of social and ecological crises. But the problem is those two desirable things are in tension, or at least insofar as the build out for the renewable energy transition involves new forms of extraction that are threatening the landscapes, livelihoods, cultures, and surrounding biodiversity of frontline communities around the world.
So that's really succinct and really quite fascinating, and probably the central dilemma for people on the left going forward. Before we continue into the book, though, I am curious about what do you think about these issues of, I guess the question that has been confronting the left is this issue of degrowth versus not. And that is a bit orthogonal, but I do think it's important maybe to lay out the stakes of that debate. To be honest, I don't really have much of an opinion on it. To me, as just a layperson observing it, it seems like difficult to be able to consume at the same level that has defined particularly American life. What is it, 20 or 25% of the world's energy and enormous amount of plastic. That seems not possible. And it also doesn't seem possible for other countries to consume at the same level of, you know, the bourgeoisie, which is what, you know, developmentalist politics in many areas of the world, if not all, want to do. But could you maybe lay out the stakes of that debate? Because I think it's a good framing thing, because like, what are we going for? Is possible, and what should the left want, Derek?
I thought this was a pro-abundance podcast.
Well, we're definitely pro-abundance.
To why you're bringing up degrowth, but I'm sorry, go ahead.
Derek Thompson unblocked me on Twitter. I mean, actually, I understand why he blocked me. I think I retweeted him, like, this guy has three BAs. That's right, three BAs, and then he blocked me initially.
why won't any of these people block me on Twitter? Jesus Christ.
You're not mean enough, Derek. You're not enough of an asshole.
Yeah, you got to work on that.
We'll have class. Sorry, Thea, please.
No problem. I mean, I think that there are a couple of different angles to kind of take up this question, but maybe one way to frame it a little bit differently and maybe even more meta than the degrowth versus like green growth or versus eco-modernist debate, which are themselves like pretty esoteric terms to a lot of people, including, you know, educated leftists like yourself. They what is exactly degrowth? What does it mean? What does the political movement look like? But I think if we kind of zoom out, there's a bigger question that the left has thought about quite a bit over the past decade, at least, which is, can we get to a more climate safe, relatively sustainable, like ecologically rational society without overthrowing capitalism or without, you know, dramatically upending the means of production and the kind of forms and habits of consumption that, let's say, at least those in the global north and those with some economic security are used to at this point? Or is there a way to green capitalism to address our urgent climate and ecological goals, but without, you know, going through a kind of revolutionary process? So, you know, that's one way to frame it. How compatible is capitalism with climate action? And I think, you know, and that's a slightly different question than the degrowth one, perhaps. The degrowth question, just more properly understood, is, you know, whether we should have an economic system which could be capitalism, but honestly, we could even look back to like industrial forms of socialism and like socialist modernity, which were maybe not dramatically better on the front of like ecology, at least historically. But regardless, can we have industrial civilization without just like completely ruining the planet? Or do we need to think about economic and social systems that dramatically reduce the kind of material pressures on planetary boundaries, on sources of resources, natural resources that we take from the planet, on the kind of so-called sinks, like the places that we kind of dump, you know, the waste of civilization? Like, what are the kind of limits to modernism, to kind of industrial civilization, whether capitalist or even another sort? So that is, you know, another entry point that maybe comes more properly from like a degrowth position. But, you know, maybe to take up the first way that I framed it, I think that what we can see right now is that capitalism, or at least a kind of mutated form of state capitalism, is completely able to deploy renewable energy technologies, to produce them, to have people consume them, to build out the infrastructures for them. That doesn't mean it's happening fast enough, it's happening holistically enough, but these things are occurring. Like, solar panels do exist, lithium batteries do exist, people do buy electric vehicles. And so to me, it's less a question of whether capitalist firms can be induced by policy incentives and tax breaks and guidance from a kind of all-seeing state. I'm referring to China here, of course, but, you know, we could see versions of this elsewhere, to kind of produce this suite of technologies instead of that suite of technologies. That seems fine. And we've had many technological revolutions in capitalism. And in those moments, some firms, you know, don't make the cut, others do. Usually the state is involved. You know, there's historical precedent to some degree for expanding and creating novel forms of technology. What there's not so much historical precedent for is destroying value outside of the context of really war or, you know, huge, you know, economic depressions. And the reason I bring that up is that deploying renewable energy is only one side of the coin, and it's really the easier side in a way of really getting off of fossil capitalism. The other side of that coin, as discussed in many books by, you know, for example, Andreas Malm, is that we need to destroy the property, the assets, the actual economic value of fossil investments. Because if we just deploy the renewable and we don't deal with the fossil, then we have what many refer to as energy addition, or an all of the above transition, in which we continue to pollute the atmosphere with carbon, but at the margins, we're kind of substituting or adding in new renewable deployment to kind of maybe address new demand for electricity, but we're not destroying the existing power plants that are doing the polluting. And so capitalism, sure, you know, Schumpeter talked about creative destruction. There are moments that through competition, capitalists might go out of business, might lose the value of their assets, but that's everyday kind of normal forms of competition. We're talking about the wholesale destruction of, you know, billions, trillions of dollars in assets, when we also think about the financial investments in these, not just the kind of physical assets themselves. And that, I think, could happen under a very, very modified version of capitalism, with a lot more state involvement, with a lot more civil society mobilization, and with like really channeling the finance sector away from fossil investments and towards something else using regulations. I don't think that's impossible in a theoretical sense, but we could see why a deep tension exists in the idea that capitalism would destroy value at that scale. Whereas I think the new green eco-modern, you know, kind of like the new tech stuff, I think that's easier to do, albeit you need a lot of state involvement to get it to happen nonetheless.
So I'm going to push back and say that I don't think it's possible that this can happen under any scenario in the current environment, because at the same time that we're supposed to be making a green transition, we're also now addicted, economically at least, to artificial intelligence and these massive energy, expansive energy demanding data centers that need to be built everywhere. Mm. And, even as we're seeing countries, China taking the lead, but other countries, making the decision to build more solar, more wind, more renewable energy, there's also this pressure to add more energy instead of replacing the fossil fuels, to add more energy. And, in some places, even like turning back to coal, which had been on the way out in favor of natural gas for a while, it feels like we're going in both directions, right? Like we're expanding renewables on the one hand, but we're actually going backwards in the fossil fuel realm to even mm-hmm. more heavily polluting, inputs. Partly because this is like we've just kind of hooked our wagons to this new industry that takes up that requires so much energy to function.
Yeah, that's a great point, and I don't disagree. But let me bring up two counterpoints at least, which are none of which are to justify AI as an industry. So I just want to make that caveat clear. But it's just to address your central question, Derek, which is it possible to expand the energy system to serve this new demand without increasing emissions, by the same count, right? Can we actually square that circle? And maybe I'll point to China, which is also undergoing a sort of AI boom. It looks different than the US-based one, and the kind of specifics of how that sector operates in China are distinct. And yet, there's a lot of AI, there's a lot of automation, there's a lot of robotics in China. So, we can take China as an example. And the reason I bring in China is because China has proven in the past year, it's a kind of world historic development, that you can expand the energy sector to meet new demand, whether it's demand from households, your population, just and population growth, whether it's demands from new industries, whether it's AI, whatever it is, that you can expand your energy sector without concomitantly expanding emissions. And in fact, China has flatlined its carbon emissions from its electricity sector. And I just want to underscore that there's no parallel to that in world history. There's no parallel in world history insofar as we've used fossil fuels since, the mid-19th century, where we see a dramatic increase, just the level of new households, new industrial plants that are getting new energy, while we've not increased carbon emissions at all. We've held them steady in China because increasingly the new energy being provided is renewable. And so, that shows that it is at least technically feasible with the right policy mix, with a certain configuration of political economy, with the right level of capital discipline, with state involvement, even at the ownership level, to expand energy provision without, increasing carbon emissions. So you kind of decoupled, let's say, not everything, but you've decoupled the electricity mix from carbon to some degree, relative decoupling, to be super annoyingly precise about it. And so, that is possible. But of course, then lots of questions are raised by what I just said. How can other states that don't have the exact political economic configuration of the Chinese Communist Party, of this certain version of state capitalism, of the tremendous mobilization of social resources and, just industrial mobilization that the Chinese, whole society represents, how can that be replicated elsewhere? I mean, that's tough, but it's good to establish things as technically feasible, because then we know the problem isn't in technical feasibility, it's in lobbying interests, it's in capitalist relations of production, it's in geopolitics, it's in culture. Those things are no easier or harder to change than technical feasibility, but I think it helps when we can say the technical stuff, is solved. What we need to turn our attention to are power relations of all sorts. Now, let me bring in my second caveat, which is that alongside this very concerning development of the AI race, and it's concerning for a whole host of reasons, but very much including climate, energy use, water use, land use, and things very germane to our topics today. Alongside that, there's a whole other development that your podcast has been super immersed in for over a month now, which is this horrific, illegal, brutal war in Iran and Lebanon. And the reason I bring that up is because, according to all the experts, but also just common sense or any news reader, while yes, we're going to see some temporary uptick in like coal usage, maybe some plants that were kind of idled or not at full capacity are now being, realized at their full capacity. We don't really see a lot of building of new coal plants, which would anyway take too long to serve the immediate issues. What we see more is a fuller utilization of existing coal plants, but that's concerning. Coal is very dirty in terms of local air pollution as well. But that said, the longer trajectory that the fossil fuel executives themselves are getting freaked out about, the longer trajectory is that this war in all its brutality, and I don't want to find silver linings, but the clear thing is that it's going to make renewable energy look like the right geopolitical decision, look like the right industrial strategy decision. And we're at a point that is a little bit contradictory from a climate perspective, which is that more and more capitalist actors themselves, governments, civil society actors, households are going to opt for renewable simply out of, quote, energy security and simply out of a desire to like eke out what's possible for economic development without being subject to the volatilities of the fossil fuel economy and its attendant geopolitics. And so we are seeing the line move in the right direction in terms of more and more renewable uptake. Even in the past few weeks, there's like kind of very fascinating data points about sales of EVs, solar panels, et cetera, around the world. The issue, though, remains that fossil capitalism still needs to be frontally addressed. And I think that while we're seeing some fascinating developments where almost fossil capitalism is self-immolating, what I mean is we see the physical destruction of gas fields, of pipelines, of oil fields in the Gulf in this, retaliatory back and forth between the U.S., Iran, Israel, Lebanon, et cetera, all the parties involved, I don't want to celebrate that. That's people losing their livelihoods and being exposed to toxic chemical pollution as this stuff is destroyed. But, that's at the margins. We need to think about at scale and intentionally and in a way that doesn't involve brutality and violence, how would we actually phase out these fossil fuel assets? That's what I see less progress towards, but I do see progress towards more and more countries opting for, a greener energy mix out of purely security interests.
Okay, Thea, let's dive into the book. This is the second time we've had you on, and we should probably talk about the book at some point. And why don't we talk
about...
We'll
get there eventually.
Eventually, yeah, and then five episodes later. Why don't we talk about lithium batteries? Because as you talk about in the book, and as I understand it, these are going to be crucial to the green transition, and they highlight these tensions that you've been discussing. So might even be interesting to talk a little bit about, start with the history, and then we could go from there.
The history has a lot of present resonance, actually, which is interesting. And we were just talking about the current geopolitical scenario and what it portends for the energy transition. And there's a kind of parallel 1970s history that are the origin point of lithium batteries. And so lithium batteries were actually first, or let's say the process that invented lithium batteries has its origins in Exxon and in the 1970s and in the US. And that it might be unexpected to hear that an oil company was part of the process of inventing a non-oil technology, but this was in the prior quote-unquote energy crisis of the early 1970s when a combination of factors from OPEC's negotiations with the Seven Sisters oil companies to a lot of nationalizations across Global South oil producers kind of put upward pressure on the price of oil, leading to what many felt was a crisis and pain at the pump and a lot of kind of backlash at politicians in the West, in the US and Europe primarily. And so in this kind of moment, oil companies were thinking, okay, what is the future? We see people maybe like opting out of oil technologies. There's also was this recurrent concern about peak oil, because this is, of course, before the fracking revolution, when we thought there was a kind of like known quantity of oil that we could access under the technologies that existed. That ended up being incorrect. But regardless, there was a lot happening, including, books written.
The old heads out there in the audience will remember peak oil, because that was a big thing. Yeah,
totally. We had a peak oil like moment in our lifetimes on this, old millennial podcast or whatever, which is like, I remember sometime in the early 2000s, but there had been recurrent, every 20 years, there was sort of a peak oil freak out, from the 1950s onward.
Yep. Derek's actually silent generation, but yeah, you and I are.
Okay, I'm sorry. Easy now.
How ageist. Anyway, so, okay. So we were in this moment and, you know, just let's go back to the 70s in a couple of other ways. We had the first Earth Day. We also have this concern, including among capitalists, about the so-called limits to growth. We have the, you know, these concerns that end up being unfounded about the, quote, population bomb and mass famine. So it was a moment that, again, has a lot of echoes with our own around geopolitics, concerns about resource scarcity, and an energy crisis. And so in that moment, Exxon particularly, you know, having some foresight, seeing the writing on the wall, is like, let's start developing some non-oil technologies so that we can kind of branch out into these new advanced energy sectors that are kind of around the corner. And so in their labs in New Jersey, some scientists start working on this lithium battery. There had been previous battery technologies, but not a lithium battery. And then, you know, then there's a longer story of how the battery ultimately gets developed that involves other collaborators from the UK, from Japan, and not to tell the entire story, but it's kind of interesting where it lands. The first lithium battery in its current kind of form was used for the Sony camcorder, I think in 1990 or 1991, that little camcorder that some of us may remember, you know, from childhood birthday parties. That was the first use of this new system of mobile energy storage. And what's remarkable about the lithium battery and what made it adept for that purpose is it's chargeable and rechargeable, and it can do that cycle many, 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 many times before, you know, it kind of reaches the end of its lifespan. It's very energy dense. It's lightweight for the amount of energy that it provides. And when we go to electric mobility, it's also very power dense. It can quickly ramp up and get you that power to acceleration. And despite there being other battery technologies out there or on the horizon, like the lithium battery remains pretty hegemonic for these reasons. And so, you know, maybe just to say a couple of other words about it, we can discuss this in more detail if we want, but suffice to say that China was really critical to the mass deployment of the lithium battery. And that might seem obvious today. China has 85% of lithium battery manufacturing capacity, so it's clearly dominant now. But not everyone knows that this has been like decades in the making. So it was earlier in the 2000s that the CCP for the first time declared electric vehicles as part of their five-year plan. And that itself was the product of the Chinese government wanting to, first of all, find a niche in industrial development that wasn't already occupied by incumbent Western firms. So, you know, firms, auto manufacturers in the US and Europe had, you know, were really dominant among traditional vehicles. And the Chinese government wanted more traditional, wanted more regular vehicles, except, you know, at the time they were just trying to build an auto sector, but they quickly realized like, we're not going to be super competitive where there are already these really behemoth incumbent powers. We need like a new sector, a new niche. And at the same time, as listeners might be aware, there was this ongoing issue with really, really unhealthy levels of air pollution in Chinese cities and industrial hubs. And people often misunderstand authoritarian regimes as like not caring about social consent. That's absolutely untrue. Now, an authoritarian regime that lasts 6 months obviously didn't put a lot of effort into consent. An authoritarian regime that lasts for many, many, many decades has obviously figured something out in a combination of preempting and subduing dissent, but also meeting popular and social needs for certain basic goods and services.
This is the Ludwig von Mises point about how every society is democratic, because if it wasn't democratic, then it would be overthrown. So he argues an omnipotent government. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's a, you know, I don't want to ratify Mises too much, but there's a truth there, which is that hegemony hegemony, you know, the idea that you have what, you know, Gramsci defined as like a baseline voluntary social consent to the powers that be is not the exclusive domain of democracies at all. And in fact, you know, there are tools available to authoritarian regimes that can manufacture that consent or produce it receive it even more voluntarily that aren't always available to democratic states. So we have to be a little bit more complex here. And so back to the China story.
And this is very, Thea, very, 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 very quickly. I think this is interesting because then this raises questions about social guilt. Like, are we all guilty for living in the American empire? And there were lots of debates about this right after World War II, of course, with the relationship between the German people and the Nazi regime. Right. Like, were the German people guilty? Were they responsible? So this is actually a key point. It's orthogonal, but we never ever talk about it. So I just wanted to make it, please.
That's fine. No, we can absolutely then think about what that means in terms of like individual or collective complicity for the other actions of said authoritarian regime. But here we're kind of thinking about seeing from the state, you know, as the book title goes, like from the perspective of the state, how do you get a modicum of social stability to achieve then your other developmental or geopolitical goals, as in the case of China? And there was a big concern because there were protests against air pollution, and then there was latent discontent that maybe wasn't protest, but was creating enough instability. And then there's also just the literal human development costs of air pollution. Like, the Chinese state is aware that air pollution kills people. And if you're trying to have a healthy workforce and an increasingly educated workforce, you know, in these new sectors with R&D and all of that, you need people to be able to live and breathe clean air. And just as a little aside, since you've already gone a couple of tangents, I'm going to indulge in one, which is that, you know, when I was learning the basics of what we call comparative politics, like sort of comparing different regime types, comparing different economic systems when I was in graduate school, I read about this issue of China and both things like air pollution or famines or other public health issues. And the kind of stated wisdom at the time was, India and China, these are the countries to compare. They're the two big populous global South nations that are on some kind of development trajectory. And they're interesting to compare because one is a democracy and the other is authoritarian. And we can like sort of draw all sorts of conclusions from that. And the prediction was that if anything, India would much more rapidly deal with its air pollution problem because it was subject to the pressures of democracy. Now you can look at the facts and see that China has just blown India away, not to make it into some weird nationalist competition, but like China has achieved reductions in air pollution that India is still grappling with that challenge really, really dramatically. And so all to say that the Chinese government was intent on reducing this air pollution problem, but they were also intent in industrializing and finding niches that they could exploit given, you know, their resource endowments and given, you know, their workforce and given kind of the global market structures. And electric mobility ticked every single box. It was a way to compete with more strength in the auto sector because incumbent Western firms were like super delayed in getting good EV models out. It was a way to address this pollution problem by replacing, you know, now you go to a Chinese city, so I've heard, I haven't been, and they're all quiet because everything is an EV. And like that also means no air pollution from at least the transportation sector. And then you also want a sector that has a lot of value add in the technical economic sense, that like has a lot of innovation possibilities, workforce upgrading, value chain upgrading, all these wonky terms. But they saw that very clearly, you know, starting in the early 2000s. And so that leads to this mass deployment, mass production, mass deployment of lithium batteries, which is another world historic achievement because it dramatically lowers the unit cost of lithium batteries, now making electric vehicles in China, for example, like much cheaper than, you know, internal combustion engine vehicles are. So that's the kind of history of where the lithium battery came from, this weird story with like the 1970s oil crisis at its origins, but then like the more contemporary story of how they got produced at scale.
And so how does that help us think about what the green transition should be? And actually, Thea, even maybe before you answer that, want to talk a little Marxist theory for a second?
Sure.
How does this reframe notions of use and exchange value? So that is obviously this sort of key distinction that Marx makes very early on. And he's like, we're going to talk about exchange value, a little bit of use value, but it's really his theory is premised on really working through exchange value. Is there a new way that this helps us rethink value 2 centuries after Capital, or a little less than 2 centuries after Capital?
That's a really interesting question that I haven't thought about before, so I'm going to go off the cuff. I mean, I think to start
with...
to start with the use value, and Marx was really specific about use value in the sense that he didn't have some weird metaphysical trans-historical notion of what is useful to humans. Like today, Marx would probably say, yeah, like a smartphone has a use value because without a smartphone, like you can't achieve other things that might be helpful, like having a livelihood or communicating with people in long distance or whatever it is. That doesn't mean he would love Apple. But what my point is that he recognizes that what is useful, which all relates to the concrete material qualities of an object, are historically, culturally, and socially specific and change over time. And so it's not like he's looking at like a basket of essential goods, like, you know, 19th century wool and like potatoes and like whatever they were was useful at that time. He understands that use is socially and culturally mediated. And that's helpful because today it is supremely useful for a variety of reasons based on the purely tactile, qualitative, material qualities of these energy transition technologies to have more of them, to have access to them, right? Like a battery has certain directly useful functions. It can store energy, it can charge and recharge, it can provide energy when you need it, you know, whenever you need it. It can provide mobile energy, so it can move along with a vehicle, whether that's an e-bus, an e-bike, an EV, whatever it is. And so it has all these qualities that are basically electrochemical, and then with its engineering design, that then create certain, you know, use cases, we might say, kind of useful things we can do with it. The problem is, to go to the exchange value, or I don't know if I want to say the problem, but the kind of interesting other way to look at this is like the economic value of the battery, or the economic value of the solar panel, which, you know, if we want to be kind of stricter Marxist about it, we would locate that value, the sort of origins of that value, in the exploitation of labor, the extraction of surplus value from the worker. You know, we could add in other elements of how we think value is created in an economic plane, but regardless, we can just be straightforward for now. And in a kind of epiphenomenal way, that's going to result in the price tag that we see. You know, price and value aren't exactly the same. We could get, again, very Marxologist about this, but that's a form of appearance of value, I think, is the way that Marx would put it himself. And so what the trick is that we need to intentionally, as a society, regardless of what our type of government is, like push through an energy transition. Capitalists won't do this on their own for reasons we've already kind of discussed. Like, they're fine producing with whatever incumbent tech they're already producing. So if you want them to produce something new, even if on the other end of that, they would profit and be happy with it, you often will need to use the state to kind of like force that transition a bit. But, you know, let's say you have that transition going and we start producing these things. There is a fundamental question as to whether capitalists are going to receive enough, high enough and reliable enough profit for what they produce to keep producing the useful things that society has decided it needs to have clean energy and avert the worst case scenarios of climate crisis, or also now with the Iran war to have a more geopolitically secure energy source. And so if there is a mismatch, meaning if there's like very high levels of social utility and very clear use values of these technologies, but the price is not right, and I'm directly quoting from Brett Christopher's book that the price is wrong, if capitalists, for whatever set of market reasons and other kind of reasons of what the costs of production are, can't expect a reliable and high profit stream for those products, they will not produce them unless we deeply subsidize capitalists. Unless, or if we had a different type of state arrangement, and China has elements of this, if we really discipline capitalists and require them and exercise capital control, meaning actually control the finance system so that finance is only allocated towards the goals that are decided upon, you know, by the polity. And so, you know, I'm not sure if this answers your question, but I think we do see right now a kind of tension between what would be socially useful on the one hand, and what there's adequate kind of price signaling and profit margins around to incentivize capitalists for their own just self-interested, myopic, you know, bottom line reasons to produce enough of this stuff. And I think that gap is where really the state comes in, and where maybe more forceful forms of industrial policy will also need to come in.
So it seems to me like in actually existing reality, what we are in practice wanting is sort of like a wise dictator in the United States, or an FDR-like figure who's going to centralize executive power, but for the good. Is that what essentially we could hope for? Because that one of the things that I'm thinking through right now, I've been thinking for a long time, is the power of the presidency, and it's just obviously too much. It's just far, far, too much for, I think we see where it goes wrong precisely with Trump. But it seems like, you know, we're not going to all of a sudden have a series of Soviets that are able going to determine a wise industrial policy to discipline finance and industrial green capitalism or industrializing green capitalism. So is that what we should go for? That we want like wise President AOC to do this by issuing 4,000 executive orders like FDR did in the 1930s? I mean, you and I and Derek, I presume, would likely want something more democratic than that, but that just seems basically impossible at this point. So what are we actually advocating for?
Like, as a member of the Silent Generation, I don't have enough time left to give a shit whether...
as a 120-year-old.
Yeah.
But like this to me is the big issue is that's what we're essentially hoping for, right? Because again, your book, like a lot of my work, like a lot of work written by leftists, it's not like the solutions are so difficult to arrive at. You know, you do various types of things. You don't do this, you do that. It's a problem of implementation. So I would love to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. Let me as always, I'm gonna agree with parts of it. I'm going to push back on parts of it. You know, you ask, is it necessary to have a green dictator, you know, to usher through a transition, especially, I think, in the context of the U.S., where we're so deeply soaked in fossil fuels in every way, shape, or form. Let's never forget that the U.S. is the world's number one oil and gas producer, right? So it's not just like, oh, we're addicted to oil and we're like importing all this oil. It's like we're a net exporter of oil. We're like a major player in the oil and gas world. And now we have countries like begging for more of our LNG because of what's happening in the Gulf. And so there's a real deep political economy behind this. We don't necessarily need to call the U.S. a petrostate. The usual definition of that is states that rely much more fiscally on the kind of oil income, which we don't as much. But in many other ways, we're a kind of novel type of petrostate, I would say. And so this isn't just about like the idiosyncrasies of American car-loving culture. It's about huge American firms, their lobbying relationships to the American government, and a geopolitical position that is protected. I mean, what I've been actually saying, I've said this in my head, maybe this is my first time saying it out loud, is that like the U.S. oil and gas sector is our Iron Dome. What I mean by that is it's a strategic asset. Like just like Israel has this Iron Dome that protects it from the consequences of its own actions, the U.S. is like Iron Dome of oil and gas production means that we can do all these things in the world that disrupt fossil fuel and energy supplies for other people, but we are protected from those consequences. And so it's hard to imagine the kind of rapid transition we need here without some major breaks, some major upending of these power relationships. But the place I want to push back a little bit is that it depends like who are the subjects being ruled by this dictator in this imaginary? Because I don't think it is or would be unpopular on the part of many ordinary American voters from kind of like left to center, broadly speaking. You can even poll Republicans in certain ways that like can get their support for like, yeah, local clean energy sounds good to me. Like, you know, I don't think that there's a major impediment, at least for some of the easier aspects of the energy transition. Easier, I mean, like just transforming our energy system from more fossil to more renewable. Easy because it's technically available to us and we've already started to do it in certain ways. In fact, I think for the past year or so, most of our new electricity growth in the U.S. was covered by solar and battery. So like it's already even happening, even if chaotic and, you know, not holistic enough and not at the level that we need. So I don't necessarily think we'd need a dictator to like win some modicum of popular support for a cleaner energy mix, for example. I think where it gets tricky is how do you deal with the capitalists? And maybe most importantly, how do you deal with the finance sector and the asset manager sector that is, and the private equity sector that is increasingly owning our energy infrastructure and other, you know, public, what should be public kind of social infrastructure. And I think there, it's hard for me to imagine getting anywhere close to where we need to be without things that rely on executive actions or court orders or regulations that don't involve like consulting with industry, but kind of to some extent telling them what to do. The question is like, how would capital respond to that? And then what type of situational class conflict would would we be in? But I do not think we need to presume that a dictatorship is necessary because this would be so unpopular. I think the dictatorship type thing, or kind of the strong arm of a developmental type state, comes in because of capital discipline more than I think actually, at least right now, like extreme levels of social discipline that would be necessary.
So you talk about resistance primarily on lithium frontiers, but what would resistance in the United States look like if, like, I mean, I'm just thinking through foreign policy, like very few people supported the Iran war. You know, there's no mechanism for change, but what would it be here? Or do you envision, I'm not using this facetiously, but like the equivalent of a bunch of Soviets somehow becoming influential, I guess, like what would be the mechanism of popular transformation?
Yeah, there, I mean, it's a hard question because we're, you know, despite some optimistic news here and there, which I'm happy to talk about, we are at a like historically relatively low level of popular or working class organization. And I think that like that is indisputable. That doesn't need to make us nihilistic or cynical, and nor should it kind of like take our attention away from where there are bright spots, which we should investigate and understand. Like, how did Zoran win? How did Katie Wilson win? How did this tenant union win? How did this labor contract, you know, this tough labor fight or battle, you know, get resolved? Like, there are a lot of places where people are rising up and organizing and getting agitated. And there's like a whole kind of wave, it seems, of left-wing insurgent political campaigns, which are very important. As someone that believes that the left does need to enter the state, I think it's great that we have left-wing folks running, you know, strong primary campaigns for Congress and Senate. So, and you know, those people in many cases have working class and or labor, you know, support. And so there's not nothing happening, but the deeper difficulty is not so much how do we build popular support for a green energy transition. I don't want to downplay that challenge, and I can speak to it in a moment, but I think there's a kind of like more foundational issue, which is just how do we get people to stop bowling alone? How do we get like a denser social fabric built? How do we reduce social alienation? How do we get people organized in their homes, their workplaces, their educational institutions, you know, in the institutional settings in which they have some leverage due to being members or workers or consumers or whatever it is? And so that's just, you know, organizing 101, and probably is not news to anyone on this call. But, you know, I think that the more organized the left is, kind of not to say that directly redounds to like immediate climate action, but it's basically good for whatever we need to do. Like if we have stronger labor movements with more leftists like in positions of power in those movements, whether rank and file or staff organizers, those are people we can talk to and ask, okay, how do you want to decarbonize your industry? How do you want to benefit from that? These are conversations that have happened in a number of unions, but we need that at scale, right? Or if we're talking to folks that are renters and are worried about housing insecurity, how can we build a housing movement where the new housing is green and affordable, right? And so to me, like the kind of fortunes of the climate left are tied to the fortunes of the left. And that itself is tied to working really concertedly on rebuilding the capacity for popular mobilization, which you know, feels bleak, but I will say that people are mad. Like, people are not happy. Like, there is not that a lot of social consent for the current status quo. That is a great starting point. And maybe to just bring in, since we talked about AI, of course, there's all of these local battles over data centers. And, you know, we can debate, okay, what's the bigger vision here? But I personally think it's cool to see people rising up and going, you know, rising up and protesting these physical instantiations of our tech overlord class. And I think the connection to the tech oligarchy, whether people's ideology is clearly formed, is like part of the reason that those protests are happening. And then just to take it back full circle to where you started the question, we also in the US, you know, this is a more maybe marginal phenomena because there's not so many new mines being opened in the US, but where new mines are being pushed by the government or corporations, we do see protests and we do see people with environmental and social consciousness. And sometimes those are places that otherwise protest is not that common or obvious, right? When I'm thinking back to some of the research I did in Nevada, and it was surprising to people there that like these movements were really forming and taking hold. And so, you know, I think that when people are directly confronted with these threats to their land, their livelihood, their energy, their water, and in which that feels connected to some larger inequality or injustice, people are getting organized. It's just that we need to think about the basics of kind of popular capacity at the same time that we think about like the kind of green edges of that.
So Thea, let's talk a little bit about the global South, and you could take this in any direction you would want, but obviously the Iran war has affected supply chains. There's this longer question of the tension between developmentalism, however defined differently elsewhere, and a green energy transition. But what is the state of play now, and what should people be looking to in the coming years?
I think be a proper materialist, as has been like a theme in our conversation about analyzing this, we have to think about the whole world. We have to get outside of the US a little bit and think about where is the future of the world system? Like, where are we seeing population growth and like new young people getting new jobs or like kind of looking ahead to their futures? Where do we have the largest consumer markets looking towards the future? Like, these are the places where where of course we want to ensure that as much as possible, the kind of greener option is chosen, whether it's how people are getting to work, whether it's what's powering the industries that they're working in. And a lot of that just sheer economic growth is going to happen outside of the US, just and primarily obviously in China, but also in Africa and Latin America and the rest of the global South. And so we might ask, like, what are the prospects for climate action and economic development to like go together rather than be opposed? And of course, the reason that those two things have been in tension for, you know, in prior years or decades is that for a long time, coal was like the cheapest and most reliable way to get not just your industrial process growing, but also your just basic energy system and electricity provision. And that was very concerning. Of course, there was a historic justice in global South countries saying, that's what you all did, Great Britain, the US, like Europe, that's, you know, we're going to recapitulate your path to development because that's the only one out there is this coal-fueled industrialization. And while that had a point of historic justice and fairness, it was extremely concerning from a climate perspective and also just from local deaths from air pollution perspective. And we're at a really different point in this equation now without, again, ignoring the remaining many tensions between development and climate action, just on the front of the physical infrastructures and technologies of an energy transition. Now, in some cases, you know, the per unit cost is cheaper than the fossil fuel equivalent. And that's in large part thanks to the kind of level and economy of scale of Chinese production. You know, what a few months ago, everyone was complaining still about dumping and overcapacity and all this extra Chinese solar panels. And now what looked like dumping looks like a great critical reserve for the global economy, because now those solar panels are going to lots of places in South Asia and Southeast Asia and Africa and elsewhere, where otherwise their energy would be simply cut off because of this crisis in the Gulf. And so, you know, we definitely have, I think, a different equation where it is cheaper, more affordable, more reliable, and in some cases more immediately accessible to go with the solar option versus the volatile oil, gas, and coal option. And so that is good for kind of green development, we might say. But, you know, the other way to think about this is that it's not just about global South states consuming this stuff, as important as that is. If we believe, which we may or may not, and we could debate, that industrialization within your own country, like endogenous industrial development, is important to other forms of social, human, and economic development, then we might say it's simply not enough for a country in Africa, the Middle East, South Asia, et cetera, to like import these solar panels. They should be making them themselves. And that's where things get a little bit trickier. And I talk about this quite a bit in the book in terms of like what options are available to global South countries to undergo their own processes of green industrial policy or green industrialization. And there are some success stories in some senses. I would probably single out Indonesia. It's not a place I explore in firsthand in the book, but I reference it and have read very deeply because it's a quite interesting case where over the past 12 years, they've banned their nickel exports. Nickel is another key ingredient in lithium batteries, and they banned the exports of the raw material, which they control the majority of the world supply of, in order to require firms to do downstream investments in refining, processing, battery plants, et cetera. And this is a way that you can leverage your raw material assets for more sophisticated forms of development. Now, there are two caveats here that are worth mentioning because they show what the tensions and difficulties are in other places. One is that this has come at obscene and really intense environmental and social cost in Indonesia. So I don't want to ignore that. We are talking about the destruction of tropical and semi-tropical rainforests in order to do nickel mining. The deforestation of that sort is the second cause of climate change after fossil fuel combustion, and in addition, destroys local biodiversity. In addition, all the refining and processing is all powered by captive coal plants. So we're then contributing to the climate issue, right? So there are a lot of ecological contradictions of the battery industry in Indonesia. But the second thing is that it's hard for Global South producers of some of the other minerals, whether it's copper or lithium, just to take two, to copy this playbook, because those markets are more fragmented and every individual country has less leverage. They can't, you know, if Chile were to say, global markets, you can't have our lithium unless you all set up shop here and produce batteries with it, then they just go to Argentina or they go to Zimbabwe, they'd go to Canada. There's lots of other places to get lithium. And so that dynamic of, do you have enough leverage to force capital to do what you want, really varies market by market. And then I guess the last thing I'll say to bring us full circle with the war is that while the war is helping, I think, to propel more interest in renewable energy technologies, and all evidence points in that direction, it's also inaugurating in much of the world a stagflation crisis, which is really not auspicious for the types of loans and finance that Global South countries need to deploy all this stuff, for their ability just to maintain people's basic livelihoods, let alone like undergo more dramatic, you know, energy transitions. And so I think that if the financing was there, this would sort of be a perfect movement forward towards green energy. But the Global South states, a lot of them, especially in South and Southeast Asia, are going to be in economic recessions. And without redistributive help and financial help from the outside, I think we're going to kind of stall some of this progress. And then we'll see kind of how it picks back up in the years to come.
I think the local environmental point is really important, right? Because the market, like the way things work now, is you send us your minerals and we'll send you back a solar panel. Like, it's not Chinese rivers or American rivers or whoever's producing these things. It's not their rivers that are going to get polluted by lithium mining or, you know, nickel mining or whatever, you know, process is being done. It's those local countries that you want to adopt this technology in a major way that are going to feel the environmental brunt of it. And unless you figure out some way to get, or unless you manage to get production into those countries controlled by people who have some vested interest in preserving the local environment, and, you know, maybe a populist reason for, you know, not wanting to you know, piss people off by poisoning their drinking water, it feels like, you know, that's just going to be a continued problem.
Yeah, I want to say something about that, if that's okay. I don't know. I know we were like concluding, but let me throw in something. I think you're right, but ... Sorry, I feel like that's literally the way I answer every question, but here we go. It's not the case that communities in China and the U.S. et al. Don't feel the brunt of lithium mining. I mean, one of the chapters of my book is about this whole onshoring and reshoring process. So actually, we're seeing a kind of mutation in extractive sectors where, to some extent, global North countries and other places like China that are major producers of this technology want domestic mining as much as possible, which means that it is, to some extent, communities in the US or in Europe. There's a number of projects that are being proposed from France to Serbia to Portugal to Germany at different stages for, you know, more localized lithium production there. And then in China, China is the fourth largest lithium producer domestically. And then it's also the number one lithium importer. So China is working all ends of this equation in terms of producing its own lithium for its own supply chains and importing because its own supplies are insufficient. And so I think that the picture will get increasingly complex around who is subjected to environmental harm and what the kind of contours of the extractive map are. However, the central point still holds, because even if we have more mining in the US and Europe, which is nowhere near displacing the amount of mining in Africa, Latin America, Indonesia, et cetera, right? So we're still going to have imports. We're still going to have all the Global South mining. But let's say we have more mining closer to home. And so US communities are among those frontline groups, like bearing the brunt of this. Does that change your basic point? No. Because the thing about the inequality between core and periphery, to use those like dependency theory ideas about like the places where raw materials come from and then the places where the industrialization, the profit and the benefit concentrate, that kind of, you know, two-sided coin of the global economy, that's a multi-scalar thing. We have peripheries in the U.S. We have hinterlands or kind of resource extractive zones within the U.S. You can go to Cancer Alley in Louisiana. You can go to the Gulf of Mexico. You can go, you know, to the Dakotas and fracking. I mean, you can go all over the U.S. and find places. Again, we are the number one O&G producer, where especially for fossil capitalism, there are a lot of frontline communities. And now we have this growing mining sector on top of that. We have a reopened rare earth mine in California. We have the lithium mine under construction in Nevada. We have a bunch of mines that were just fast-tracked by the Trump government. So, but the thing is, those communities, right, are exactly as you said in the Global South. They're not exactly, I don't want to over-exaggerate. They're not as poor. They're not as subject to violence, et cetera. But they are receiving the environmental harms without always getting the immediate, you know, social, environmental, and climate benefits of those technologies. And so I think that inequality of core and periphery is multi-scalar, you know, it's at sort of every level, and it's going to be increasingly closer to home and harder to ignore. It's not an exotic over there problem with geopolitics and state capitalism and onshoring. Lots of societies on Earth are going to confront this extractive dilemma.
That's a good place to leave it. Thea, thank you so much again for coming on the program. And I feel like we did actually talk about your book this time, which is a positive. The book is Extraction, The Frontiers of Green Capitalism. We really love having you on. So anytime you want to come back, we look forward to it.
I'd be happy to come back, argue a little more, hear more about Marx and Mises and Keynes and whoever else Danny wants to bring up at me. And, you know, the green dictator AOC of our future. It's all interesting to me.
Inshallah. All right.
Indeed.